Hey there, everybody. I'm so excited today. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food, and this is going to be a major love fest today. I'm just warning you, okay? Are you ready? I am. I've been looking forward to this since last week, actually. I've been having a good time on this show, and I hope you've been having a good time learning and discovering everything about food, my favorite subject. And more, I'm going to be connecting the dots between food and all life on Earth, because it is all about food. Terrific. So I want to welcome my first guest, Del Saruf, and he is the author of the China Study Family Cookbook, which we'll be talking about today, as well as three other cookbooks, the China Study Quick and Easy Cookbook, Forks Over Knives, the Cookbook, and Better Than Vegan. Saruf is also the co-owner and chef at the Wellness Forum, where he delivers great-tasting plant-based meals to clients in Columbus as well as throughout the continental U.S. Saruf also joined the Wellness Forum as a member, where after a lifetime of yo-yo dieting, he has lost over 200 pounds on a low-fat, plant-based diet. He teaches cooking classes at local venues like Whole Foods, community recreation centers, and the Wellness Forum. Learn more about Del at chefdelsaruf.com. Del, how are you?
I'm great, Karen. It's good to be with you again.
So I am going to give you the virtual five-year, fifth time on It's All About Food robe.
Wow, I'm excited.
So this is like Saturday Night Live when Alex Baldwin or Steve Martin come out with their plush robes with the five on it. And this is your fifth time on It's All About Food. And I don't have many people that come back very often. So congratulations.
Thank you so much. Do I just have to keep writing cookbooks to get invited back a sixth time?
Well, unless you... not necessarily. Because
okay.
The last time you were on the program, I don't know if you remember, but you were actually on to save the day because I think it was Leanne Campbell who was scheduled to be on, and she had a... and she couldn't make it for one reason or another. Do you remember that? She was having a total health conference or something, and then there was some crazy thing.
Oh, yeah.
And well,
I'm happy to be a fill-in guest. I'll be. It's fun for me. So whatever you need.
Okay, so we're going to talk about the China City Family Cookbook today, and I want to say, Del, you have outdone yourself this time.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm excited about it.
And I think my favorite part of the book is breakfast.
Yeah, me too. Well, you know, breakfast, yes.
No, really, you've outdone yourself. So the first thing I wanted to talk about is using whole food ingredients and why that's important and why some people may not realize it's important. So, you know, we've gone through this industrial age, and in some ways it's been good, and in some ways it's been absolutely horrible. And when it comes to food, the industry has been putting in all of these low-quality, cheap ingredients, cheap either because they're cheap or because they're subsidized. And people are used to this food, and the health is degrading as a result. But in all of your recipes, which are fabulous, people can have all of their favorite comfort foods, and I will bet that they taste better than the foods that they're used to, because the ingredients you're using are not only whole foods, but they're quality foods.
Right. They're real food.
They're real.
They're real food. And if you've been eating food out of a box for most of your life, as a lot of people have, then you're going to taste real food for the first time. And I think that's the exciting thing about that. And it's interesting. You know, this is my fourth cookbook. I feel only more encouraged to write cookbooks this way, not with just real food, but real food that you can get at a regular grocery store, right? Don't have to go anyplace special to get these ingredients. These are right there in front of us.
Exactly. You know, I was talking to someone recently, and I'm not going to say who, because it doesn't matter, but he was talking about all of the new products that are available and making them accessible.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm like you. I'm really into, you can go to any grocery store, get the beans, get the dates, get the whole foods, and make spectacular food.
Well, look, if you're a person that's eaten, if you grew up in an Italian-American household and it's spaghetti and meatballs all your life, then what the heck do you want to do with quinoa? I love quinoa. But if you're new to this, you know, quinoa looks like some sort of foreign invasion to you, right?
Yeah.
You know,
if you look at it closely, it can creep you out because it's got that little spermy thing in it or something.
Yeah. And if hamburgers and French fries have been your things, then you're not going to go for the. I don't know. It's just you have to sort of approach meet people where they are to the best that you can, and I'm just trying to do it with real food so that they can. Understand what they're eating and mm-hmm. not be so freaked out by it.
Okay, so some of the fantastic things. You're sweetening with dates or date puree or applesauce.
Yeah.
And these are all great ways to get the sweet into the food.
Yeah. Well, when you sweeten with dates, when you sweeten with whole foods, then you not only get the sweetness, but you get the fiber, and then you get all the nutrients in those dates. And dates are more than just the sweetness. They are packed full of vitamins and minerals.
Michael Greger at NutritionFacts.org has a video on sweeteners and mm-hmm. what the most nutritious sweetener is. And, mm-hmm. of course, he always saves the best part for last, like it's... like a thriller or something.
Right.
But dates were the winner because they're a complete food when you're getting that. It's nature's candy. When you get that sweetness, you're getting the fiber and you're getting everything else.
It's nature's candy is the perfect way to say it.
Okay, let's say it again. It's nature's candy.
It's nature's candy. Eat up.
Okay, fantastic. So I just dog-eared a few recipes.
Oh, perfect.
First one, I'm going to be making this weekend for my partner Gary DeMattei's birthday. Don't anybody tell him. Chocolate donuts.
Yes. I made these for a week-long cooking immersion last week, and we did them in class, and everyone was like, what just happened?
I bet they taste better than real donuts.
Well, they're real food.
I'm sorry. That was the wrong thing to say. I can't stand when people say, oh, you're eating fake cheese. No, I'm eating plant cheese or I'm eating, plant whatever. But these are real donuts. Thank you.
These are real donuts.
Real donuts. And they're made with whole wheat pastry flour, cocoa powder, sweetened applesauce, date puree, plant milk, vanilla. And then they have a little frosting that's got sweet potato puree in it.
Yeah. So, and the best part, you're going to eat two or three donuts, which is going to fill you up, one. Two, you're not going to have that sugar crash an hour later where you have to go lay down.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, I have to admit, the last time I had something that I thought tasted like donuts, it was purple potatoes.
Ah, okay.
I don't know, and we did it all wrong because we were in Florida. And we got them from my favorite Josh Steinhauser's Farmer's Market in North Hollywood. I don't know if you know Josh, but he's if you ever meet him, he is like high on green juice. He's always bouncing off the walls, full of energy guy. And he's got a fantastic Farmer's Market. But they were selling purple potatoes. And we were staying in a little beach place. We only had a microwave. So we microwaved them. Anyway, they tasted like donuts.
Oh, wow. I need some of that.
Yeah, but anyway, I'm going to try these chocolate donuts. And then moving on, I just wanted to mention the sweet potato hummus.
One of my favorite recipes. You know, I've been making hummus for almost 30 years now in commercial kitchens, and I get a little bit bored with just regular hummus. It's still a part of what I do, but the day that I made sweet potato hummus, I fell in love with hummus all over again.
So I just have to make a pedantic, obnoxious statement.
Go for it.
And I'm just going to say it, and then we'll just pass on. Now, hummus, of course, in the original Arabic and Hebrew languages, means garbanzo bean.
Mm-hmm.
And we have kind of taken that word and made it our own, which happens to a lot of words in vocabulary.
Yeah.
And hummus now means like a creamy spread.
Yeah.
And so this sweet potato hummus doesn't have any garbanzo beans in it.
No.
But it's got tahini and sweet potato puree, lemon juice, garlic, cumin, salt, pepper. It's a fabulous color, and I'm sure it's fantastic.
And I tell you what, I make the distinction between hummus and then other bean spreads. And here's the difference. Here's when I keep it at hummus. When I'm using, this is a traditional hummus recipe minus the olive oil.
Ah.
So everything else in there you'll find in a traditional hummus. And then all we're doing is replacing the chickpeas with sweet potatoes. And so I'm okay with that translation, that artistic license, if you will. But when I make plenty of white beans, like I make a cannellini bean spread with rosemary and lemon juice and garlic, I do not call it hummus.
What do you call it?
I call it a white bean spread. But I try to respect a little bit of the cultural heritage of the food that I'm eating because I love that.
Yes.
You know, I love that history has a history and a story and an origin.
I love that, too. Thank you.
Yeah.
I think,
definitely.
Yeah, food history is important.
Well, yeah.
What I learned about garbanzo beans recently? I don't want to call them chickpeas anymore.
Oh, really?
I think I learned this during the Food Revolution Summit. Maybe it was Vandana Shiva. But anyway, what she was talking about was how when the British came along and occupied India, and they noticed all the beans that the people were eating, they thought those beans were animal feed.
Oh, wow.
You know, chickpeas for the chicks.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Fascinating. Anyway, so they're garbanzo beans now.
Well, I'll be with you. I'll call them garbanzo beans, and I'll give you another quick one. You know, I use millet in a lot of recipes.
I was going to bring that up. Thank you for bringing that up. Yes.
It's one of my favorite ingredients. But, you know, in America, most of the millet that's grown is used for bird feed.
Right.
And, in fact, I get people who I show the recipe to, especially guys, and they're like, that's bird food. My older brother, that's bird food. I'm like, oh, God.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about millet and why we love it.
Well, you know, it's an ancient grain. It's been around forever.
It's gluten-free.
It's a versatile grain. It's packed full of vitamins and minerals and all of those things that we love. And it's versatile. And it's easy. It's quick cooking. It's 20 minutes to cook. And you can do so many things with it. I first encountered it in a Moroccan millet pilaf that one of my favorite cookbook authors' recipes, and loved it. But then the second time I saw it was out of a pita cookbook where they made meatloaf out of it.
Mm.
And
you
made
chorizo out of it.
Yeah.
Right,
I make chorizo, I make meatballs, I make everything like that out of it because it holds together on its
exactly.
own. It doesn't need any binder.
You know what I discovered recently? Somebody told me this on this show, but I never got around to doing it, and that was you can make your own millet flour from millet, just putting it in a Vitamix.
Oh, yeah, Vitamix, the power of the Vitamix, certainly.
Yes.
Oat flour, too.
Awesome. Then the last recipe I wanted to talk about was the mushroom bacon.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about bacon on this show from time to time. The unfortunate thing is all of those bacon lovers who don't really care about where the bacon comes from. And all they really are interested is in that salty, sweet, fatty flavor.
Yes. Yeah. And it's just as easy to get out of something like mushrooms. You know, if you think about a bacon, like not a crispy bacon, but the kind of the oven-baked bacon that they do, so it never really gets crispy, but it has that softness to it, but then it has the salty and the sweetie. You can get that out of mushrooms.
I know.
You can get that out of mushrooms.
Yes.
And oh my gosh.
The other thing I didn't mention yet in this cookbook, which is a little different from some others, is you've included some interviews with people and given their personal anecdotes.
Yeah,
nice.
I love this part of the book. It really was a fun thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting side of it, you know, I interviewed the Campbell family, Dr. Campbell, who wrote the China Study, and his daughter Leanne, and their stories about how they became plant-based and how they came to it. Is not only interesting, but, you know, the most interesting thing about them is that their entire family adopted this diet. It's Dr. Campbell, all of his children, and all of their children eat plant-based, which is a rarity.
Yep.
And so I included their story for that reason, but then you see other stories of people who, to some level or not, the family is either on board or they're not, and how they deal with that. And I think those stories are important, too. Because we're not striving here for perfection. We're just striving to move forward in a better direction.
That's it. In a mouthful. that's right. And the Campbell family, they're like the plant-based dynasty.
They're the royalty.
They're royalty, yeah. Absolutely. And it looks like you've been adopted into their family with the China City Family Cookbook.
I would be thrilled if that were the case. They definitely seem to like my writing cookbooks, and I love them. I mean, I consider them really, really some of my favorite people. They're the nicest family on the planet that I've ever met. They're just as nice as it gets. But I certainly have been blessed to have been allowed this opportunity to write a couple of cookbooks for them.
Okay. The last thing I'm going to say before we go is I always like to talk about cauliflower with you, Del.
Yeah.
And I couldn't not mention it. And in this book, you have a few recipes with cauliflower, and one is the autumn vegetable pot pie with biscuit crust.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You could make that for me sometime.
Okay, well, we need to work that out. I guess I'd be happy to. happy to. But, you know, the cauliflower is still, although, you know, the new book has a cheese sauce recipe that's made from potatoes, I still have a fondness for the place of cauliflower purees for making sauces and, mm-hmm. and cream-based things. And people that I feed it to, even people who don't like cauliflower, love the mouthfeel and the taste. That, you know, it takes on the flavor, again, of whatever you do to it. The taste that you come up with it and the things that you can do with it, it's a totally versatile food. So I'm all in on the cauliflower still.
Fantastic. Del, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Always fun.
And
always fun. Thank you.
Yes. Thanks for writing the China City Family Cookbook, 100 Recipes to Bring Your Family to the Plant-Based Table. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Okay. Are you salivating? I'm just very hungry right now. Dangerous talking about food when you haven't eaten since this morning. Okay, well, I want to move quickly because I have some fantastic people here in the studio, and I can't wait to get started talking to them. We have a couple of representatives from the new Empire State Humane Voters. Woo-hoo-hoo! I'm looking at Allie Feldman-Taylor, who is the founder of the new political advocacy organization for animal protection, Empire State Humane Voters, which launched in 2017. That's this year. She was named to New York Observer's Political Power 80 in 2014 and named to City and State Magazine's 40, Under 40, Political People to Watch in 2016. She's an alumni of Florida State University and lives in Bed-Stuy with her husband, Scott, and three rescued cats, Willa, Waffles, and feline Dion. And then we have John Phillips. He is a well-known political figure in New York and a nationally recognized leader in the animal protection movement, hailed by former Governor David Paterson as one of the great animal rights activists in the U.S. His numerous successful efforts to pass laws protecting animals have earned him accolades and awards from the U.S. Congress, the New York State Legislature, and the New York City Council. In March 2009, John was named one of the 20 under 30 standout stars of the animal protection movement by Veg News Magazine, the premier magazine covering vegetarian issues and animal welfare. John's been active in the animal rights movement since he was a teenager, and I can verify that and talk about that in a minute. Vegetarian since age 9 and vegan since age 14. He founded and was executive director of the New York League of Humane Voters, which was a force in NYC politics for years. John was an early supporter of NYC Mayor Bill de Blasio and helped to defeat the animal's greatest enemy in city government, Christine Quinn. In the 2013 mayor's race, he's the current political advisor for Empire State Humane Voters, a statewide political organization for animals. He lives in the East Village with his partner, Chris, who's also here. Hi, Chris. And their two rescue guinea pigs, Neptune and Blackberry. Hello, everybody.
Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Thanks
okay.
so much for having us.
Yes. So, John, yes. Before we really get started in the meat of this program, the plant meat of this program, I just wanted to get a little nostalgic here. So I'm looking at you and I'm filled with pride and nachas and joy.
Thank you.
Because I knew you when so long ago, and you've really grown up.
You were one of the first activists that I met in the movement, and I always tell people when I am talking about you that I probably wouldn't have stayed in the animal rights movement if it wasn't for you, because you were so welcoming and
well, you're making
amazing.
Me tear up.
No, seriously. I mean, as I think everybody in this room knows, and probably a lot of the listeners know, a lot of animal people are a little, you know, not always the most people-loving people. Mm-hmm. So I'm very fortunate that you were one of the first people that I met, because it really did.
Well, thank you. You were an awesome volunteer back then. Thank you. And I remember not knowing anything about websites, and you sent me a page of HTML code that I used for years.
Really?
Until awesome. I memorized it.
Yeah, I think actually when I met you, my dream, I was going to go into computer programming. That was my theory back then, and then I decided, nope, want to do animal stuff.
Animals really, I'm sure, are grateful for you, as so. I am. Okay, let's get started.
Can we talk about dates, though?
Dates?
Those dates. I am a big fan of Dell, because I follow Dr. Furman religiously, mm-hmm. so no salt, no sugar, no oil. So his Forks Over Knives cookbook, I don't know if he's listening, but
okay,
I'm
wait a minute.
Fan.
You follow religiously. I see your posts on Facebook
when I go to restaurants.
all the time.
But even when I go to restaurants, I try to avoid.
You're careful.
Like I don't eat like deep fried food or.
Right.
But at home, no salt, no sugar, no
Excellent.
Oil.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm the same way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We need to have you over for dinner.
Yeah, definitely. Yep. Anytime.
Okay.
Thank
good.
Thank you.
Tell me about this new organization, Allie.
Sure. So first, thanks for having me. And just one quick correction: my cat. It's Celine Dion, as in rhymes with. as in Celine Dion, but Celine Dion. Important note there. So thank you so much for having us. And this is actually Empire State Humane Voters Radio debut.
Yay.
Only on It's All About Food on the Progressive Radio Network.
And of course, John has been a huge inspiration behind why I founded Empire State Humane Voters. He was actually the first person I met who was both political and an animal person. And I credit much of what I've learned today from the work that John has been doing over the past decade to set the foundation for where we are today in the humane voter movement.
Thank you.
So I'm thrilled to be working with him today. I think that the two of us are going to, you know, really be able to take New York City and New York State by storm, from Buffalo all the way to Long Island. And we're just getting started. We started this organization because there is a dire need for a statewide group that will address a plethora of animal issues across New York State. There really isn't an organization that is full-time, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, working to register, get animal people registered to vote, training them on how to get politically active in their community, educating candidates and elected officials about animal rights issues, making endorsements, and of course holding our elected officials accountable to the laws that we can get passed for animals. I think in the last, you know, certainly 6 months or so, while it's incredibly unfortunate what we've seen happening at the federal level, it has created a huge opportunity for us in New York State to really take advantage of the need for building a political organization here in New York. And while there's going to be a lot of challenges in getting stuff done at the federal level under Trump, there's so much work that we can get done in New York to make sure that we can protect the animals that are here in our home state.
I remember talking to the lawyer, Steve Wise, who's advocating for chimpanzees. And he was talking about how all he's committed his life to is kind of moving the law in millimeters to help animals. And what he's doing is working at it at the localist level he possibly can. And that's how he feels like he can make change. So working at the local level is really important, and engaging people in their communities, which is something a lot of people have gotten away from because we're lazy and we want convenience and we want to know somebody else is taking care of things, but they're not. We have to do it.
Well, what we see happening, and you're absolutely right, and what we see a need for, which is why we created Empire State Humane Voters, is that the typical toolbox for an animal rights activist, just like you and me, is to eat vegan. It's to talk to our friends and neighbors and our family about going vegan and about plant-based foods, and to talk to them about compassion. And it's to go to protests and hold signs. But where we sort of have fallen short is we as a community need to make sure that political activism is just as big a part as every advocate's day-to-day toolbox for advocating for animals. Yeah. And so one of the big focuses that we're going to be putting our time and resources into is making sure that we can train advocates on how to plug themselves into the political fabrics of their communities, training them on how to run for office, helping animal advocates get jobs and internships with elected officials, having different workshops on how they can volunteer on campaigns, how to go knock on doors for candidates, how to phone bank, all of these skill sets that are absolutely needed if we want to make long-term change for animals by getting laws passed. And these are things that we see in just about every other issue area, whether it's environmental causes or LGBT rights. Those are staples in those issue areas, but they're not yet a staple in the animal rights movement. And that's what we seek to do in the long run. We know it's not going to happen overnight, mm-hmm. but we're planting the seeds right now so that this next generation of animal rights advocates understands that it's not just about eating cruelty-free. It's about getting politically active in your community and holding your elected officials accountable.
What's remarkable, I think, is that the animal movement, 99% of the organizations that exist as charities. So they're legally prohibited from engaging in political activity. So what ends up happening is that the charities lead the way, but they're not allowed to get involved in politics. So elected officials get away with doing whatever they want, voting however they want, and that's a really big problem for the movement.
I just want to say, I'm not going to say that this is good or bad, but our so-called president may actually change that.
It might motivate people to get involved.
Well, in order to benefit religious organizations, he may change that so that they can get involved in politics. So some of our nonprofits may be able to get involved. I don't know that that's a good or bad thing, but
I've always wanted to start a church of veganism.
Well, but, it is a church in some ways. Yeah, Gary and I have talked about that many times.
Yeah. It's my faith.
That's right. I believe. Woo!
Yeah, totally.
And I talk about proselytizing all the time.
Totally.
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, tell me, what is a humane voter?
So a humane voter is someone who is willing to go into the voting booth and make their decision based on whether or not that candidate supports animal welfare.
And so the word humane is implying non-human animal welfare.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good to know, because I don't know that that's obvious to everyone, because when you say humane, you're thinking about humans.
Well, I think it's aspirational. You know, we want to – the way that we treat animals speaks to how we are as human beings.
Now, there are other humane voter organizations around the country, right? Are you connected to them at all?
No, we're not. But there are other political organizations for animals that work at the local and state level.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. So what's your first big thing? I know you've got one.
So the first big thing that we're working on is a bill in the city to ban the use of wild animals in the circus. And we've had tremendous success with that over the past few weeks. We've doubled the number of sponsors, more than doubled the number of sponsors. We've gotten the mayor to come out in support of the bill.
And I saw that video. That was awesome.
Wasn't that great?
Mm-hmm.
And the chair of the committee is supportive. It's a bill that I've personally been working on with the sponsor for 11 years, believe it or not. And unfortunately, the past administration was very opposed to the bill. Mm. Mayor Bloomberg and former Speaker Christine Quinn, they were both pretty anti-animal. But fortunately, now we have a new administration, we have a new mayor, we have a new speaker, and the stars have kind of aligned for getting that bill moving. So hopefully, you know, we feel good about it. We think that it might be our first victory. So we're knocking on wood and crossing our paws. And hoping.
Well, the time is right.
Yeah.
The time was not right 5 years ago, or I couldn't even imagine it 15 years ago. But let's talk about Ringling Brothers and how it makes it right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a tremendous victory for the movement, one that I didn't see coming. Certainly not 11 years ago when I went to the sponsor and we first talked about doing the bill. We never would have dreamed in a million years that Ringling Brothers would close on their own. But in reality, it wasn't, you know, their own. It was their decision, but it was motivated by all of the local legislators all over the country, all of the state legislators all over the country who were introducing ordinances and state laws to, you know, put them out of business. And I think they, I mean, they've said in the media that they were getting tired of fighting it. They were getting tired of fighting the activists.
I'm smiling so, right now.
Yeah. No, it's a yeah. wonderful thing. And it's a huge victory for the movement. But now we have to go, we have to codify that into law. We have to make sure that other circuses can't come to New York and another industry like that never takes root. Because I think with other issues where we had significant victories, like with the fur industry, when people stopped wearing fur for a while, we didn't get that codified into law. We didn't.
Mm-hmm.
We
so didn't, it came back.
Yeah, we didn't seal the deal. So we have to translate public support into law. We have to, you know, make sure that we capitalize on that public sentiment and do away with it forever.
What I'm remembering about Ringling Brothers, tell me if I'm correct or not. At first, they agreed to eliminate elephants from the circus, but what people didn't realize were there were other animals involved.
Yeah.
But now that they're closing, that's the end.
That's the end of Ringling. I mean, unfortunately, you know, we'll see what happens with the animals, but it's the end of the biggest circus in the country. It's probably one of the biggest victories for the animal movement in a very long time.
There's a photo, you've probably seen it, of the elephant stepping out of the train. What a crazy picture that is.
Yes,
it's shocking and sad. I mean, who would think of cramming this elephant in this human transportation thing? It's just not humane, mm-hmm. but it is because humans do it.
Yeah.
Anyway,
one of the reasons why we first did the bill when we did was because 11-12 years ago the Bronx Zoo decided that they couldn't accommodate for the social or physical needs of the elephants that they were keeping, and so we always made the argument that, you know, if the Bronx Zoo can't do it, the Bronx Zoo is like one of the quote unquote best zoos in the world. If they can't do it, how can Madison Square Garden accommodate for elephants? How can the Barclays Center accommodate for elephants? How can, you know, they be transported around the country 50 weeks out of the year? It just doesn't make sense.
Can I tell my Bronx Zoo elephant story?
Sure.
While we're here. Okay, so there have been a few stories recently in the news about children accidentally getting involved with zoo animals, and some of them to unfortunate ends. This story isn't that bad. But when my sister was really young, she was, I don't know, 3 or 4, and she was wearing a precious little red coat. I guess I wasn't there, so I don't know exactly what happened. But she was holding her coat, something like that, and the elephant came and grabbed her coat. I guess the red was appealing or something, but it was quite a scene.
Wow.
When she was very young, and that was the elephant at the Bronx Zoo.
Elephants are very touchy-feely. Actually, Chris and I, my boyfriend, and we went and volunteered at the Elephant Nature Park in Thailand, and we got to interact a lot with the elephants, and they're very touchy. I was very surprised. Like, they'll come up to you, and they'll, like, put their, you know, trunk on you.
There's a lot more to elephants than we want to acknowledge. I think they're very wise and very loving, and they're not going to be around much longer, which is the sad reality. Yeah, you know, I was talking to Damien Mander. Mm-hmm. Was it last week? Anyway, he's amazing working in the bush in South Africa trying to prevent poaching, which is just an incredible thing. Okay, so what do we need to do to make this happen?
So a couple things. For one, on the circus legislation, we are getting very, very close. Well, we've got the majority of the city council in support of the bill, and we're getting much closer to a point where the council may be actually voting on it into law. So if everyone can please, if you go to eshv.org/action, you can call or write your city council member right there from the screen. It's super easy. And then after you do that, make sure you share it on Facebook and let all of your friends and neighbors know that they too need to call and write their city council member and encourage them to co-sponsor and vote for the bill. This year is a huge year, not only for Empire State Humane Voters' inaugural year, but we have a great opportunity that can make a big difference for animals. And that is, there are 7 open seats in the New York City Council. So that's seven opportunities for us to elect people who are going to support our issues, the issues that matter to animal lovers in New York City.
Can I just take a minute to mention that every council member in New York represents 160,000 people.
Mm.
So when we think of city councils, I think when a lot of people think of city councils, they think of like this, you know, group of like five or six people with no power and no influence. But in reality, the New York City Council is one of the most powerful legislative bodies in the world. The budget for the city council is $60 billion.
Oh.
So it's a very influential institution. It's a very important institution. New York City, so goes New York City, so goes the world, I'd like to think. So it's an important body. It's important that we elect people to the city council because people don't really pay attention to it.
So can you just give a brief description of what it would take to run for city council?
Well, where do we begin?
I think when Ali said that, maybe we were talking about in a couple of years we can help people do that.
You're not ready. Okay.
This year we're looking, we've identified people who are running already who are sympathetic to the cause, and we're gonna
help them.
Mobilize people who are, you know, passionate about animals to go and vote for them. But certainly if you're out there and you're listening and you want to run for city council and you love animals and you can raise, you know, $250,000, contact me.
Okay, that's good to know. And where do they contact you, John?
John@eshv.org.
Okay.
Yes,
we would be thrilled if more animal people came out and said, hey, I want to run for office. We'd be the first to line up to run your campaigns for you.
Okay.
But this year, so the process is we survey candidates who are running. We send them a questionnaire. We ask them to elaborate on their position on a variety of animal issues. Then we sit down with them. We talk to them about animal issues, or we go out for a meal at a vegan restaurant. We talk to them about what's going on at the city level, how they can help. And then we evaluate the race and see if they have a chance of winning and if we think that we can have an impact. And then based on that, we would endorse them and campaign for them and do all that.
We will notify all of our members about who we're supporting. We will knock on doors, we'll make phone calls, we'll do everything to mobilize the animal protection community in these specific districts and make sure that we get out to vote for them on election day. Or in some instances, if we if necessary, we may mobilize our people opposing a candidate who doesn't support the issues that are important to the animal rights community.
Do you have any other issues that you're planning to work on other than the circus animals?
Sure.
I mean, how do we put that?
We're calling it the Wild and Exotic Animal Ban.
Wild
but
and
we
exotic.
Can call it the circus ban if you want.
Yeah. No, I'm following your lead.
You could also call it Intro 1233, which is the name of the bill in the city council. So some other issues that we are going to be taking up are the pets and housing bill. This issue has been around for quite a while. As we know, housing problems are always an issue to every New Yorker. What we see happening is landlords will take advantage of the sort of murky pet laws that we have for tenants and use that as a way to throw people out. So let's say that you had a cat for 10 years and your landlord never had a problem with it, and then your cat dies and you want to get a new cat. The landlords will sometimes use the lack of clarity in the law to tell you, well, if you get another cat, then you're going to have to move out. And when they kick you out, then they can jack up the rent. So this legislation would further clarify the pets and housing rules. So that way it would make it much easier for people to replace a pet when it dies. There's also
it's not the sexiest issue.
It's not,
but
it is important.
It actually impacts on a lot of people, and I think that we need to make sure that there are as many homes as can be for all the animals that are in need of homes.
I don't think any of us realize the number of crazy laws on the books all over, federal and state and regional. I mean, there's some just crazy stuff, and we need to turn them around.
Well, in this particular instance, the real estate industry really manipulated the interpretation of the law to benefit themselves, because the original intent of the law was that if you had a pet and the landlord waived the no pet clause in your lease, that no pet clause would be waived for the duration of your occupancy. But the real estate people came in and they said, nope, actually the no pet clause is waived for the lifetime of the individual pet. So what happens is that people end up being there for many years and then their pet dies. And it's a great way to force out rent stabilized mm-hmm. tenants.
Yep.
But other issues, you want to?
Sexy issues, yes. Or not so.
So some other issues. I mean, this one is, I don't know how sexy this one is, but ending the proliferation of storefront slaughterhouses. We've all seen them in the city. They pose not just a terrible problem to how the animals are treated, but it's also a major sanitation health risk to New Yorkers. So we will be proposing legislation that would not shut down the existing storefront slaughterhouses, but put a moratorium on opening any more in the future. And eventually, the ones that are existing will probably end up closing up shop at some time in the future, and then they won't be able to open any more going forward. Other issues are making sure that our city's animal shelters have the funding that they need to operate.
And the locations.
Right now, there are full-service shelters in Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Staten Island, but the Bronx and Queens do not have full-service shelters. And so a first-rate city like New York needs a first-rate shelter system. And the shelters currently do a great job of with the resources that they have, but we need to make sure that the city council is consistently providing them with the funding that they need to continue taking care of the, 30,000 animals that are coming through their doors every single year.
Mm-hmm.
There is also going to be legislation coming up that deals with animals who are left outside in inclement weather, in hot or cold weather, when it's snowing, when there is a heat wave. Oftentimes what will happen is people will call the police and say, hey, someone's left their dog outside for 8 hours during a snowstorm. And there's really not that much that can be done unless they change the laws to protect these animals and increase the penalties to the people who are doing this.
That's just incredible, isn't it? That's just one more thing that I love about humanity, how cruel we can be and yeah. thoughtless. And some of these people will say, I'm a big animal lover, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the rule right now is that as long as you're providing some sort of physical structure for the dog when they're in their backyard, you can leave them out there no matter how cold it is. But this would seek to change that and also increase the penalties.
I think it's amazing when you actually look at the laws that don't exist. Like, I mean, the fact that you can force feed a duck or a goose until their liver swells to like 10 times its normal size. The fact that that's legal, that kind of blows my mind. You know, like what does that say about humanity that we allow things like that to happen?
I want to think we're good, John, and I'm looking in your eyes and I know you're good, but you're one of the few.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. But on the bright side, even if, there's not that many of us, our numbers are growing and small
Absolutely.
Organized minorities drive politics in this country. Mm-hmm. So we only need a handful of passionate people to affect real change.
I mean, I would disagree. I don't think there's not that many of us. I believe there's between 3 to 6 million pet owners, pet guardians across New York State. And if we are to organize and mobilize those millions of people, imagine how much leverage we can have in New York State to getting these laws passed. That's a huge voting block potential.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask about breeding?
I'm not going to have kids.
Me either, John. I remember there was a law in New York recently about
the
breeding.
Puppy mill bill. Yeah.
What do you know what that was about and where your stand is and where we are with
You're talking about the bill. There was a bill to ban the sale of animals from puppy mills.
Yes.
And it's a great bill. It was unfortunately, my understanding is it was gutted by the Trump administration's decision to remove USDA reports from.
So this wasn't a state bill? It was a federal?
No, there was a city bill.
Oh, okay.
To make sure that animals wouldn't be sold from puppy mills and places with violations, but the administration pulled the records which detail the violations. So unfortunately, that information is unavailable right now, but I know there are activists who are trying to restore that information.
Okay. Yeah, I got it.
John, did you want to tell us a little bit about humane education and why that's so important?
Sure. So the way that I see it is that we need humane education in schools, not only because it's been a law that's been on the books since 1948, but also because we need to, you know, raise the next generation to be humane voters. We need new members. And also because it's just the right thing to do. Humane education is a law that's on the books, and it requires that every school that gets public funding have instruction in the humane care and treatment of animals.
And the But they don't.
And in fact, the penalty provision in New York State is one of the most severe in the country. A school that doesn't comply with the humane education law can have their funds withdrawn. So that's never been enforced. It's never been tested. It's not something that we're looking to do. But it is something that schools need to be aware of. And we've worked with HART and with other humane education advocacy organizations to try to increase compliance with the law, notify schools of the existence of the law, because we find that that's a big barrier to
implementing it.
They just don't know about it. If they knew about it, they might be more willing to do it.
So when they find out about it, what did they do? They just go, oh, shit. Or they like, we don't care. Or what happens?
I've never heard, oh, shit.
Okay, good. But,
I think that a lot of times they will just say that they're very busy. They're overwhelmed with all the standardized testing requirements. And they are sometimes hesitant because of that. But HART does amazing work. And, you know, when we've connected them, when I've connected them with schools, sometimes it's taken off. So I think that it needs to come also from the parents and the students. They need to say that they want it as well.
This is a New York law?
It's a New York State law, wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Since 1948.
Hmm. Okay, so what else do we have?
Other issues?
That's a big
agenda.
That's a lot.
You want to give us more?
Yeah.
I think it doesn't even have to be just issue focused. The organization exists because we need to get people into office who are concerned about these issues generally. So, you know, we don't have to take on every issue that's out there. We elect people who are sympathetic to the cause, and then we can get rid of these very difficult issues and then go talk to them again about, you know, doing other things as well.
So New York City is very different than the rest of New York State.
Yeah.
So much so that New York City is pretty blue and the rest of New York State is kind of red.
Yeah.
How does that affect your work and what you're going to focus on?
Sure. Well, the wonderful thing about animal protection issues is that they really don't side with any party. They're not partisan. I believe that the latest polls have shown that 90% of Americans across parties believe that animals should be treated with kindness. We've seen at the state Senate level and then the state assembly, we've seen Republican senators and assembly members take leadership roles on animal protection legislation. And I think that that's really refreshing to see, especially with what's going on throughout the country right now. So no matter what you're registered as, whether you're a Green Party, whether you're a Democrat, whether you're a Republican.
Or on the Progressive Radio Network.
Or on the Progressive Radio Network, of course.
Yeah.
No matter what you are, everyone is welcome to become a part of Empire State Humane Voters.
So in New York City, we have the horse-drawn carriage issue. Mm-hmm. And are you making a statement or involved in that at all?
So I'll just speak from my own experience, not for Empire State Humane Voters. Ali can speak about this after. It's an issue that I've been very passionate about for a very long time, and I know that a lot of people were very disappointed when the bill did not pass. But I think that that is a perfect example of why this organization is necessary, because the bill failed in the end because there were 7 sponsors, and the support wasn't there in the city council. So I think one thing that advocates need to always keep in the back of their head is that no one elected official, no matter how sympathetic to the cause, can get everything done. So
you're not blaming the mayor?
No.
I don't blame the mayor. I met with the mayor several times about the bill. And the mayor, I know from personal experience, did a lot to try to get the bill done. Unfortunately, the the support wasn't there in the city council. And we, wow. You know, there's 51 council members. We had 7 sponsors. It was a heavy lift. So you can't expect any elected official to spend all of their political capital on any one issue. So it's our job as activists to make this year very important, to go back and do the work of electing a new city council that will be sympathetic to that and every other animal issue. Yeah. And to hold the people, I think we need to hold the city council members who stabbed us in the back mm-hmm. on that issue accountable. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that that's...
I mean, we just had that horrific accident recently with a horse and a car.
Yeah, no, it's unbelievable to me that that industry exists.
I mean,
in the
frankly, 21st century. I don't think we should have horse-drawn carriages because there's no need to. This is 2017. It's just ridiculous. Yeah. But this has nothing to do with animals. But I don't think we should have any cars in New York City, actually. It should be a car-free city.
That would be amazing. That's a heavy lift.
That's a heavy lift. Yeah, I know. Oh, well.
But, you know, I'm with you.
I mean, just to add to that, you know, I worked on the horse-drawn carriage ban for over 5 years. Mm. And, you know, what John is saying is absolutely correct. I can understand and appreciate a lot of the frustration that there is with the mayor. Certainly, he could have moved faster. You know, I think we lost a lot of momentum when he waited a year to introduce the legislation, and that gave the opposition a year to erode all of the progress and all the support that we had been building up. However, at the end of the day, I think that we can't look at one person and blame it all on him. The mayor did introduce legislation not once but twice to get the carriage horses off the streets, and both times we just could not get the support from the city council. I think, you know, I understand where the frustration comes from, but what I would recommend to activists is remember, a lot of the city council turned their back on this. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of city council members who promised that they would help get the horses off the streets, that they would support the ban. And then as soon as they came under pressure, they completely reversed their position. The mayor, on the other hand, has yep. never changed his position. He's always been solidly behind yep. this, even to this day, after he was completely, you know, given a really hard time in the press.
Unprecedented attacks by the media.
Unprecedented
the Daily
attacks.
News doesn't run petition yes. campaigns on any other issue.
The mayor they still stood strong yeah. throughout just relentless attacks because of his position to protect these horses. And when city council members flipped, it was like completely silent. Hmm. Nobody held them accountable. So if you're listening today and you're upset about the carriage horses, what I would recommend you do, go look up your council member, find out who they are, look at where their position is on horse carriages, and make sure that you're holding them accountable to supporting the ban, because it really comes down to them. If we don't have a majority of the votes in the city council for the carriage horses, the bill doesn't pass. It's as simple as that.
I'm 100% sure that if a bill got to the mayor's desk, he would have signed it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt in my mind. And I think that that's something that activists need to remember and keep in mind.
Yeah, that's really good to know. Okay, we just have like a few minutes left. Can we talk about the great food in New York, the great
yes.
vegan food
anytime.
In New York?
Amazing.
I mean, clearly, John, I know you know because I see the pictures all the time. You and Chris go everywhere. So tell me about some of the fun places you've been in the last week.
In the last week?
You went to
Yeah. I don't know how they're pronouncing
it. I don't know, but it's delicious.
It's amazing. It's so good. Everybody should go there. It's on East Broadway and Lower East Side, and it's terrific. Get the, what is that thing?
The bottom of Canal
the
Street.
The burrito. Oh, the burrito. They have a new burrito on the menu with, what is it called? The thing, the spicy meat, that spicy
chorizo.
Vegetarian. Chorizo, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, veggie chorizo, very good.
We were just talking before, Del Saruf has a chorizo recipe.
I'm try
he uses
yeah.
millet.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've tried to make millet. I used to get the millet at Angelica Kitchen.
Uh-huh.
They cooked it in carrot juice. It was pretty good.
Hmm.
I'm not a big fan.
Okay, well then.
I love Angelica Kitchen, but I have to give millet another chance.
See? I don't know. Millet and carrot juice? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep. John is more, he's a healthy vegan. I'm more of a junk food vegan kind of girl.
Mm-hmm.
So
what
order,
do you like?
Oh, Champs, Toad Style, Blossom, you know.
Yeah, we like the Blossom Burger a lot.
Yeah.
That's Gary's favorite.
Yeah. Really?
And actually...
He's a burger boy.
Do you want to talk about our city council project?
Yeah, please. Yes, no?
Oh, yeah. So council member Fernando Cabrera is hi, council member, if you're listening out there. I don't think he listens to the Progressive Radio Network, but he is exploring becoming vegan. And so we're very excited. Yay. So we're trying to...
Feed him. Are you trying to feed him?
Yeah.
Well, yes. The best way to do it is to put that good food in people's
but
mouths, right?
I've turned him on to Dr. Furman, and Dr. Furman and I are actually going to meet with the council member. To
Fantastic.
Try to,
I love Joel Furman.
Yes, me too.
Give him a hug for me.
Yeah. He's amazing.
My favorite
He's my
doctor.
Favorite. He's my favorite plant doctor,
okay.
for sure.
Yes.
I Everybody's like you, Dr. Greger. I like you, Dr. Greger.
Yeah.
But
Furman, yeah. But, you know, the difference is, I mean, Dr. Greger is awesome, but he doesn't have an office with patients.
Yeah,
I totally. Mean, Furman is right there.
Yeah, he's like
getting his hands dirty. Yeah.
Now, New York City is blessed with food. Mm-hmm. It's going back to the food thing.
Yeah, please.
Yeah.
So we have 2 minutes. More good food.
More good food. Candle Cafe West.
Oh, Modern Love.
Yeah, Modern Love's pretty
so good.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, Candle still my favorite.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Candle West, that's like
it's
where
my
we go.
Yeah.
Oh, Rock and Raw, Quintessence.
Oh, May Kadee. Shout out to May Kadee.
Oh, right. I wanted the to new, ask yeah, you about yeah, that. Yeah. I haven't been there.
Yeah. Oh, she you still haven't been there. I know she was on your show.
No, she came in and it was for an interview. Yeah. And it was just so festive. She had
she's
on
amazing.
The garb
totally.
And everything and brought me some wonderful things to taste. But tell me about the restaurant.
The restaurant's amazing. So she has a chain of vegan restaurants in Thailand and Cambodia. And I met her when I was in Thailand and loved her food and was so excited when she opened here. And, like, the most authentic vegan Thai food you'll ever have. It's very delicious.
I want to
and she's trying to be organic. She's trying to be, like, 100% organic.
I want to repeat her name. May, M-A-I, Kadee.
M-A-Y.
Oh, it's May, M-A-Y.
I think so.
Oh, okay. Maybe it's M-A-Y. You're probably right. And K-A-D-E-E, something like that?
I
and is that the name of the restaurant?
Yeah.
Okay. Because she has another name.
29th? Is it 28th or 29th? I don't know. 28th, I think, between Park and Lux.
Right. Fantastic. Yeah. Okay. Vegan Thai with no, you don't have to say, is there fish sauce in this? Because there isn't any.
And she has cooking classes. Well, thank you so much for having us.
I love
you,
John.
We're so honored. I love you, too.
And it's wonderful meeting you, Allie. Thank you both for joining me on It's All About Food. And thank you all for listening now and whenever you're listening. And thank you for caring and thank you for being interested in responsible eating and living. That's where I live. And remember, you can always find me at info@realmeals.org and visit responsibleeatingandliving.com. And Allie, what's your website?
Our website is eshv.org. You can go to our website, you can sign up for our emails and stay up to date on everything that we've got going on as we take off this year.
Excellent. Thank you all. And remember, everybody, have a delicious week. Bye-bye.